Chapter 15. Incident Record Lookup. Nuclear Shatter Bomb Strikes. Open parentheses, terrestrial, close parentheses, open parentheses, question mark, number, close parentheses, open parentheses must include fleet, close parentheses. There are three recorded instances of a fleet vessel engaging in a shatter bomb strike on a planetary system since the invention of the technology. None of these instances has occurred in the past 400 years. Though there was a public debate about the usefulness of a threatened deployment in Nikkar system two indictions ago. That public debate resulted in a general social distaste for the idea. \\access\\information. Access limited database query performed 96.1.1-19A by Fleet Captain 16 Moonrise. Personal cloud hook from secured connection on the parabolic compression. All subway service in inmost province suspended until further notice pending investigation by the Ministry of Science. Message repeats. Expect delays. Choose alternative forms of transit. All subway service in inmost province suspended. Public service announcement. Wide broadcast on the Jewel of the World. 96.1.1-19A. Down in the sand and the heat again. Paloa 2 closed around her like a strangling cloak. 18 hours hadn't dimmed the sun. This planet rotated slow. 18 hours had thickened the smell of charnel rot. Mahit had expected it, and choked on it anyway. The body forgot pain. That was one of the first things LaSalle Station's Imago integration therapists had taught her when she was small enough to just begin to think about how it would feel to be part of a long chain of Imago memory. The body forgets pain, but it also writes patterns into itself. Endocrine response and chemical triggers. Biofeedback that sets patterns. That's memory. Continuity plus endocrine response. The charnel smell again. And the sick heat. Repeated experience. Mahit wanted to gag. She thought, Iskander, were you ever on a killing field? And got back, no, not until you. So this was something new she was adding to their Imago line. She wasn't sure how to feel about that. Walking back to their plateau platform was different than it had been the first time. She was still frightened, still terrified, to be perfectly clear about it in her own mind, if nowhere else, of the aliens they were talking to. But she had sung to them once, and she could do it again. And the composition of their little expedition was different. The same four escorts with their shock sticks. The same canopy made from the most Tixkalanli piece of silk Mahit could imagine bringing. But with the addition of 20 cicada, vicious with his tiny box of deadly fungus and his questions to ask. It was going to be Mahit's job, somehow, to find a way to ask those questions. In a language that wasn't language, on a planet so hot, she thought she would faint. Three seagrass kept brushing against her as they walked. At first Mahit had thought she was staking some sort of claim. I've had my hands inside you and now you're mine. And she'd recoiled from the idea with a violence that evoked a wincing sympathy from the echo of Yaskander's memories of Sixth Direction and his bed. But then she realized that it was almost certainly unconscious. She was just standing closer. Some wall dissolved. An easy intimacy, like any other lover Mahit had ever had. Not different at all. And the continuity of endocrine response worked for everyone, stationer or Tixkalanlitzlam or something else. Endocrine response said, in that brutal language of the flesh, this person has had their hands inside you, and you welcomed them in. Let's do it again. Here are nice chemicals to help. On the crest of the plateau, the aliens were waiting for them. They weren't the same aliens. First and second were replaced by what Mahit immediately called third and fourth. Two more of the same species, but obviously two different individuals. Both of these were of a height, a good foot and a half above Mahit's own, not counting their ears. And one was heavily modeled, dark and light in a roan pattern, while the other was a nearly unmarked gray, with one large black pigmentation mark that spread over half of its face. They had clearly been waiting some time. Mahit wondered if the whole lot of their negotiation team was going to be eaten for rudeness before they even got around to saying hello. She decided to head that off at the pass. Either they'd be eaten or they wouldn't be. And was that easy fatalism the chemical cocktail of endorphins and oxytocin in her blood? Or just her being more Yuskander than they'd been before? That bravado, the simplicity of decisions. She walked up to third and fourth, came just to the edge of the reach of their claws. The sun raked her, felt like a weight on her skull. And she opened her mouth, took a lungful of desert air and sang, "Hello," as loud and well as she could. She was still hoarse from the last time she'd done this. It would be harder this time. But three seagrass came up to her side and sang with her, and even 20 cicada attempted to join them, a light tenor, not very resonant, but singing. And third and fourth, after an agonizing pause, sang back, "Hello." They were in business. The escort team set up the canopy and the audio proj and their new toy, a cloud hook rigged for office work, the kind that spread a corona of files and feeds around its wearer, but this one manipulable by any hands that came near it. Three Seagrass had called it a strategic planning modality. 20 Cicada had just said that it was a strategy table, the kind the fleet planned wars on. No time for language learning now, no time even to decide if what they were learning was a language. Given, these aliens communicated and understood communication. Given, they communicated in a way that was not visible to Mahit, nor any other human being, as well as by sounds. Given, they seemed entirely willing to eat entire planets alive for scraps and leave the waste to rot in the sun. All of those bodies dead. All of those people dead. Given all of that, it was time for crude rebus drawings in Holo. The most disturbing part wasn't that third and fourth picked up what she and Three Seagrass were doing very quickly, drawing lines of light in the shimmering desert air with their claws. The most disturbing part was that they both simultaneously seemed to know everything first and second had done the day before, and that they moved in that awful, unsettling, uncanny joint motion that first and second had also displayed. Third would finish a gesture that fourth had started, draw the other half of a figure that fourth had begun, and they had precisely the same skill in drawing, the same skill and the same style. It was like they were two links in an imago chain, but both embodied at once. The idea made Mahit squirm. But wasn't she herself a thing that was wrong, by all the standards she had learned on the cell station about what was the right and the wrong way to be a link in a long line of live memory? Communicating by rebus and song snatch was slow and agonizing in the heat. They were circling around the idea of, it wasn't anything so concrete as cease fire, maybe something more like managed retreat. If Mahit could only figure out why these creatures did what they did, she could get closer to asking them to do it somewhere else, somewhere far away from LaSalle Station. And takes Kalan. And oh, Daj Taratz was probably going to give her to Aknel Amnardbat on a platter. But she couldn't get to why. She didn't have any abstract concepts to work with at all. Except, carefully, when it was her turn to begin the next sentence, phrase, communication unit, Mahit drew the outline of a human being. The outline of a human being with its guts spilled out in spirals of light. And above it, the outline of an alien, the long neck, the carnivore's claws. Three Seagrass said hurriedly, "I don't think this is a good idea, Mahit." But Mahit had her mouth open already, and the shape of the sung spat noise on her tongue was the pidgin word for stop, for no, or cease, or stay away. Don't kill us. There was a heat-struck silence. third lifted a claw. Its hands were so delicate under those claws, and Mahit thought they were retractable, that they'd fold back for precision work, and did not rip Mahit open. Nor did it sing anything back to her. Instead, it drew another human outline next to the eviscerated one, and another, and another, and another, as if to say, but you can make more of you. How wide, after all, could the concept of you stretch? Could it be as wide as a species? On her other side, 20 Cicada, his bald head gold gone angry pink in the sun, his cheeks a sallow gray, heat drained, sighed softly. All right, he said. Enough of this. What? Mahit began, confused. But he had already produced his box of fungi, his box of maybe poison, and held it out for both third and fourth to see. Held it like a prize, or like a challenge. He pointed to the box. The alien eyes fixed on it like it had the gravitational pull of a black hole. And then he pointed to what Mahit had drawn, the dead human, torn up, wrecked. He shook the cube. The whitish fungus inside, dried to nothing now, rattled. The sound was too loud. Were there no insects on Paloa II? Was there really nothing here but silica sand and sunlight? The soundless communication passed between third and fourth, that impenetrable language again. They opened their mouths and sang, together, a bone-rattling noise, a wave of nausea. Mahit recognized something of the sound pattern she and Three Seagrass had identified as victory, but shifted, made otherwise. She was so lost. She couldn't talk to these things, these people. They were people. She had to keep thinking of them as people, even as she tried not to vomit up everything in her stomach, without language. If she was a poet, you should have been Taixkalanli. What a poet you would have made. A poet like Three Seagrass. Then all of the vast weight of Taixkalan had sent the wrong sort of storytellers here. What good was poetry now? One of the escorts was talking to Three Seagrass, rapid and hushed, in Taixkalanli, and for one terrifying moment, Mahit didn't know language at all. All syllables were useless sounds. Breathe, said Yaskander in her mind, like he had before. But this time he said it in stationer, the language she'd drunk in with her first breaths of oxygen, and it snapped meaning back into place for her. Sounds had meaning. Words were symbols. She could think in language again. Three Seagrass touched her, her fingers on the underside of Mahit's wrist. We have to leave, she said. And Mahit had to work to parse it, to hear words in Taixkalanli that weren't all narrative, all implication. We have to become absent. We have to excise ourselves from here. What? She managed again. Useless interrogative particle. Her brilliance, the Emperor, 19 ads. She wants us to send her a message, both of us, now, on wait for the wheel. The courier's waiting. We can't, Mahit said. They're not. Behind her, third and fourth were approaching 20 Cicada, circling him. He stood perfectly still, holding his box of fungal death. Perfectly calm. Mahit wondered if that was what being a homeostat cultist meant. Not minding being about to die via enormous predatory enemies. A claw tapped the box, once. The click of keratin on plastic. 19 ads wouldn't ask for us if she didn't need us, Iskander said inside Mahit's mind. And with that came all of his certainty. That 19 ads was worth the absurd, agonizing, death-inducing amount of trouble she'd gotten him into, back when he was alive. All of his certainty that he'd loved her, and that it didn't matter in the end, and he'd loved her even so. Go on, said 20 Cicada, strange and distant. Take the shuttle and our escorts. I'll be all right here, I think. What are you going to do? Mahid said. I'm going to bring them back a little piece of their dead, said 20 Cicada, still not moving at all, and then see if they understand anything about why I did. Go. Third was drawing in the light again, a fractal shape, like the fungus, a shape that it laid over the image Mahit had made of an eviscerated human body. I don't know what's right, said Three Seagrass, but 19 ads sent me here, or at least she didn't stop me, and she's the Emperor. And Yaskandar echoed, She's the Emperor, and this adjutant can take care of himself here, even if he can't sing. Don't die, Mahit said, uselessly. She didn't even like 20 Cicada. Everyone dies eventually, 20 Cicada said, fourth small inches from his face. Mahit thought, everyone dies, except memory, and then turned to follow Three Seagrass back to the shuttle, and the fleet, and Takes Kalan, waiting. They'd left 20 Cicada down in the desert with the enemy. 9 Hibiscus hated it viscerally, and she couldn't exactly argue with the decision, especially since the envoy and Dasmar, the spook and her pet, and oh, sometimes she'd really like to excise all of 16 Moonrise's turns of phrase from her mind, had brought back with them the sworn promise that it had been Swarm himself who demanded to stay. It was so exactly like him, she believed it. It was precisely the same kind of deliberate use of the self in possible sacrifice as he'd done behind the sealed doors of the medbay, waiting to see if he'd die of breathing fungal spores. She hated it anyway. She could wish her adjutant, her dearest friend, her longest friend, was less interested in keeping the whole world, the whole empire, the universe, in balance and more interested in selfishly saving his own skin, for her sake, if nothing else. While the envoy and Dasmar went to answer their urgent imperial communique, supervised by 2 Foam, 9 Hibiscus took an hour of leave from the bridge. She was owed 9, but who needed 9 hours of sleep? She didn't go back to her quarters. She went to 20 Cicadas, straight away. And he still hadn't changed the password, of course. The door let her in. There was an autoplay message rotating in hollow above the work terminal he usually kept tucked away in a corner. It read in the perfectly neat glyph style that 20 Cicada wrote in. Malo, if I'm not here, water the plants and feed the star-cursed Kuranian kitten. She was not going to burst into tears. That was a fail-safe message, not a goodbye. Nevertheless, she watered the plants. And when watering the plants revealed said star-cursed Kuranian kitten, who had been sleeping in one of the plant pots like a strange void-black root vegetable, a root vegetable that yowled at her when she poured water on it by accident, she fed it, too. There were small bits of vat meat for it, which it seemed to enjoy. She was still feeding it. It had come to sit on her knee and purr and eat vat meat from her fingers, which was unfairly cute. When her cloud hook alerted her to a priority message, sent on the command-only broadcast band. She played it, without thinking. All messages on that band needed to be heard. This one resolved into 16 Moonrise, her image flooding one half of 9 Hibiscus's vision, while the other half stayed clear. She wasn't on wait for the wheel any longer. She was on her own bridge, on the parabolic compression. 9 Hibiscus knew she should feel relieved. But she didn't. Not in the slightest. She petted the Kuranian kitten so it would stop yowling for meat, which only partially worked, and listened. Yautlek, said 16 Moonrise on her distant flagship. I feel it is incumbent upon me, considering that you are my superior officer, however much we disagree with one another, and also considering that you are aware of the terrible capabilities of our enemies, both in their ships and in their bodies, to inform you that I have learned what I am sure you already know. One of your scouts has found one of the enemy's home systems. Don't blame your officers, they were entirely closed-mouthed. But the 24th Legion is just as clever as the 10th, and when the gravity rose altered its trajectory and search pattern to fly home right through my Legion, it became obvious that they had found what we are all looking for. I have confirmed, with my own scouts, what the gravity rose found. I am preparing a strike force. I am willing, if you are willing to offer me the command, to lead it. The parabolic compression beside wait for the wheel, cutting through our enemy so that we might get close enough to burn them all out of the sky. Sanitize what might infect us, what will undoubtedly eat us. I understand that you may wish to wait for your negotiators to return from their negotiation. I too will wait. For a time. My Yautlek, I would rather die ending this war before it leeches takes Kalan of vitality than live through a long siege of attrition. I think you would too. And besides, you are the hero of Kuran. Perhaps we'll all make it through alive. The message ended. The other half of Nine Hibiscus's vision resolved to 20 Cicadas' Garden of a Suite. Ah, bleeding fucking stars, she said. The Kuranian kitten looked at her, offended, and leapt off of her lap. When the Emperor's Azwazwa cat sent a message on fast courier, it went even more quickly than when the fleet sent one. 5.5 hours, Five Agate had said. 5.5 to get the request and 8 antidotes list of questions to the flagship wait for the wheel, and then however long it took to record an answer, and 5.5 hours back. She'd sent him to bed while they waited. He'd resented that. But he'd also guessed he'd deserved it. He'd gone out into the city and had to be rescued, and there was the ever-present wondering of signal problem or incendiary device running through his head. He'd asked Five Agate if she'd heard from the judiciary, and she'd told him to go to bed more firmly instead of answering, which either meant she hadn't or she had, and it was the bad answer. The incendiary device answer. But 8 Antidote had gone and slept, and was glad he didn't dream at all. He was sure he'd have dreamed of train derailments if he had. The message to the envoy was supposed to come back to Palace Earth by noon the next day. But it didn't. It didn't come back by dinner, either. And 8 Antidote picked desultorily at his spiced livers and cheese in their lily blossom wraps, even though he loved fried flowers normally. He was too nervous to eat. Everything seemed to be spinning just fractionally faster than he could keep track of. No one would tell him about the subway, and he didn't know how to get his cloud hook to give him more useful information than what anybody could find out on the news feeds. He had to stop watching the news feeds after a while. Seeing the smoke come out of the subway tunnel was making him feel sick. It wasn't until just after sunset that Five Agate sent him an infofiche stick in the internal palace mail, asking him to come and see the answers to the questions he had asked, to see, apparently, not only Special Envoy 3 Seagrass, but also Mahit Dismar. 8 Antidote wondered if the fact that the message had both of them was a sign that Fleet Captain 16 Moonrise's message of warning had been correct. Information was compromised by the ambassador from Lascelle Station. Or if 3 Azimuth had been correct, Mahit Dismar disrupted protocol and the right functioning of the world wherever she was, whether she meant to or not. When he got to the Emperor's suite, Five Agate was waiting for him on one of those white velvet couches. She wasn't alone. She patted the seat beside her, which meant 8 Antidote was going to watch this hollow with the Emperor herself, sitting on his left and Five Agate on his right. Five Agate's child, 2 Cartograph, who had made it very clear to 8 Antidote that he was 7 years old, a whole indiction, and wasn't going to go to bed until he wanted to, was reading a mathematics textbook, sprawled out on his belly on the Emperor's tile floor. 8 Antidote didn't think he'd ever done that, when his ancestor the Emperor had lived here. He didn't think he'd ever been that comfortable doing it. Five Agate asked him, or asked her brilliance, it was hard to tell, "Shall we hear what 3 Seagrass has to say for herself?" And played the hollow, before she got an answer from either of them. It wasn't just Envoy 3 Seagrass. It was her and Mahit Dismar, right beside her. On the hollow, both of them looked very tired and sweaty and not happy at all. They were in a small room with metal walls and a window. The hollow didn't pick up much of the starfield that should have been outside that window, but 8 Antidote could guess what it looked like. He couldn't see if there was anyone else there, listening to them make this recording. But from where they'd both put their eyes, Dismar kept glancing to her left and 3 Seagrass was very deliberately not looking left at all. He thought there was probably someone. Someone who made at least Dismar nervous. What he'd asked in his message to the fleet was simple. Why do you believe, Envoy 3 Seagrass, that negotiating with our enemies will succeed? And why did you choose to go instead of anyone else from information? Only those two questions. He just wanted to hear her justification, to try to understand her at all, and see if he believed what she was doing. Envoy 3 Seagrass had a clear alto voice run ragged. She sounded like someone who had gone to a very loud concert and sung along with the band, or a person who had been really enthusiastic at an Amalitsli game the night before. She looked straight at the recording Cloudhook, so now 8 Antidote felt like she was looking straight into his eyes. Direct eye contact. He wanted to look away, and she wasn't even here to look away from. Your Excellency, she said in exquisitely formal tense. Ezwazwakat, your brilliance. My most esteemed greetings to you on the Jewel of the World. From the flagship of the 10th Legion, wait for the wheel. I apologize for the brevity of this message, but we are, as you might imagine, somewhat busy. There was a pause. An emotion rippled across Dismar's hollow image face, and 8 Antidote thought it might be stifled laughter. The laughing that adults did when they were horrified and didn't want children to know. You ask very complicated questions in small and simple packages, Your Excellency, 3 Seagrass went on. Ambassador Dismar and I will not be able to give you the sort of response you deserve, considering time and other factors, but she, Mahit here, she gestured at the ambassador, is of the opinion that you deserve answers when you ask for them, especially at such a remove. Beside him, 19 ads murmured, she would think that, wouldn't she? And you don't? 5 Agate said, as if 8 Antidote wasn't right here and they weren't all talking about him. Oh, on this, the ambassador and I have tended to agree quite profoundly, said 19 ads. And 8 Antidote remembered, harsh and abrupt, what she'd said to him when she'd given him the spear point. You're not 6 Direction, no matter what your face looks like. I made sure you didn't have to be. He wondered again what exactly she had done, for him or to him. But the envoy was speaking again, and the hollow going on without respect for a conversation happening 5.5 hours in its future. You want to know why I took this job, instead of anyone else from information? That's the simple question, Your Excellency. I wanted to. The request came in, and I wanted to. Wanted to do something more than sit in my office and not sleep very much and fail at writing poetry. Next to her, Dismar murmured, Reed. Soft and sympathetic. That must be the envoy's use name. It was strange that the ambassador knew it. Stranger that she'd use it. 3 Seagrass waved her off, a little falling gesture of one hand that seemed to mean later. Ask her brilliance about wanting to do something, if you don't understand it, Your Excellency. I'm sure she's watching this with you. And if you still think you don't know why me, and not anyone else from information, ask her why she didn't stop me, or send someone else with me. 19 ads laughed when the envoy said that. Laughed and nodded. 8 Antidote was very sure he was being manipulated. Over more than 6 jump gates and 5.5 hours of time. But it was so strange and refreshing to be manipulated by being earnestly told the truth. He needed to learn that one. In the hollow, the envoy sighed. Your other question is harder. That's why I'm sitting here with Ambassador Desmar. She understands languages better than I do, even if I'm a much better diplomat than she is. It's not her fault, she's... Three Seagrass looked as if she'd eaten the first word she'd meant to say, swallowed it back quickly, and replaced it with... out of practice. Why do I believe that negotiating with our enemies might succeed? Because they talk, Your Excellency. Because when we figured out how to make communicative sounds that they knew were communicative, they talked back. Because I grew up reading 11 Lathe. Get 5 Agate to get you a copy of Dispatches from the Numinous Frontier. You're a 90% clone of his brilliant sixth direction. You're old enough to understand it. Desmar interrupted her, carefully, like a swimmer diving into water without a splash. Because, Your Excellency, the envoy likes aliens. Likes human aliens, at least. She told me so when she met me the first time, because she, unlike some Tixkalanlitzlam, thinks humans who aren't Tixkalanli might be a kind of human. It's easy to get from there to thinking that aliens might be a kind of person, even if they aren't human persons. Mahit, said Three Seagrass, like she was shocked. But the ambassador went on. I don't know how they talk. I know they have more languages than the ones we've learned how to say words to them in, and that at least one of those languages isn't one a human can hear. I know they don't care about death the way we do, but that they do understand death. I know that they came back to the negotiating table after the first meeting, and that they haven't stopped attacking the fleet, even during the negotiations. I know all that, and not much more. But I think they might be a kind of person, and if they are... If they are, Your Excellency, said Three Seagrass firmly, there is the possibility of a brokered peace before we lose too many more fleet ships. That's all. A murmur in the background. Whoever else was with them saying something inaudible. Desmar looked frightened, or nauseated, or just annoyed. Stationers had too many expressions, and it was hard to tell what they meant. The envoy looked serene. That is all. End recording. And then the hollow vanished. And there was only the Emperor's living room suite. And two cartograph looking up from his homework on the floor, saying, Mama, does 8 antidote do matrix algebra? Because I can, and I solved all the problems while you were watching Hollow. 8 antidote missed being 7 years old, he decided. Being 7 was so much simpler than being 11. He got up off the couch. He wanted to think about what he had just seen, and not talk about it. Not with the Emperor herself, or 5 Agate, or anyone. I can do some matrix algebra, he said, and sat down next to 2 cartograph. You want to show me? They came out of the recording room with the evaluating, watching eyes of 2 foam, wait for the wheels comms officer, still fixed on them. 3 Seagrass had ignored her very determinedly the entire time they'd been on Hollow. It was easier to ignore her than to deal with simultaneously being observed by suspicious fleet personnel. At least they weren't wearing isolation gear any longer. And being called back to the flagship to answer not a summons from the Emperor herself, but some sort of evaluatory question sequence from the Imperial Air. It was like getting an Are You a Good Cultural Fit for My Team job placement interview from an 11-year-old. An 11-year-old who looked exactly like every picture of his brilliant Sixth Direction, from when Sixth Direction was a child. 3 Seagrass had been just about willing to turn around and get back on the shuttle to Paloa 2 and let the kid deal with wanting to know for a few hours. Her answers would have been more complete anyway if she could have kept working on the negotiation, kept trying to make the enemy understand that really, they didn't like casualties very much at all, not even slightly. But Mahit had shaken her head, had said, if anyone deserves answers about why Tixkalan does what it does, it's that child. And then 3 Seagrass had remembered, quite vividly and with some embarrassment, that 8 antidote had been born to be 6 direction. To have one of LaSalle's station's Imago machines in his head, So Six Direction could have been emperor forever. She guessed that Mihit felt complicatedly guilty about that. And if Mihit was really more Yaskandaragavan than she'd been 6 months ago, she probably also felt thwarted, frustrated, and guilty. Which one of them had she fucked last night? Which one of them had brought along that strange, lovely graphic story with lines like, "It's precious, but it's not a memory," and "I'm everything you need"? Did she really want to know? Probably not. When it came right down to it, when she was in front of the holo recorder with Mihit to her right where she belonged and a disapproving fleet officer tucked in the corner, 3 Seagrass decided to tell the kid as much of the truth as there was and see what happened. It was worth, well, it was that if she was going to do anything, she was going to do it right. She'd been like that her whole life, the thing entire or not at all. 9 Hibiscus was waiting for them on the bridge. 3 Seagrass bowed to her over her fingers, deeply, and Mihit did the same. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the Imperial Fast Courier Shuttle glitter on its way to the jump gate, their message inside it, passing across the windows of the bridge. There. Gone. And here they were again, alone with the war.
"Have you heard anything from Ikantlos Prime 20 Cicada?"
3 Seagrass asked. She kept thinking of him, alone with Third and Fourth and his box of fungi. Alone in the heat, like she and Mihit were alone with the war. "Not yet," said the Outlek. "Nothing since you arrived. He has, another half hour before I send you both back down to get him, if he can be gotten." 3 Seagrass suspected that if he didn't radio in, there wouldn't be much left to get. She'd be sorry about that. Very sorry. It would be a waste. A waste in the way 20 Cicada had explained it to her on the hydroponics deck. A flaw in the way the universe should function. A perversity. A use of resources that wasn't the best use, or even a good use. Maybe she'd become a homeostat cultist if she ever got home from the war. Or at least read some texts about it.
"We should go back anyhow," said Mihit. "We weren't finished."
"The situation has shifted," said the Outlek. 3 Seagrass winced internally. That was never a good line for a negotiating partner to deliver, not in any poem or handbook or case study she knew.
"How so?"
she asked. 9 Hibiscus's face was unreadable. Everything about her looked closed off, protective, angry. She didn't want to tell 3 Seagrass what she was about to tell her, but she was going to do it anyway. Probably because she didn't want the Information Ministry, or LaSalle Station, to screw up whatever it was she had decided to do. This was going to be extremely unpleasant. 3 Seagrass attempted to brace herself. Mostly, she felt exhausted. "The scout ship Gravity Rose has found one of the inhabited systems of the enemy," said 9 Hibiscus. "A planet and its satellite."
"And?"
asked Mihit.
"I'm waiting for Swarm to come back with something more actionable than, 'They want to keep talking, or they're full of fungal infiltrates and we cannot trust they're dead.' And if he doesn't, well."
For a moment, 9 Hibiscus looked like she had the first time 3 Seagrass had seen her. The absolute perfect image of a Yautlek. Star bestriding and unmovable.
"Well, then the fleet knows where their heart is, and I am prepared to sink my hands into it and tear it out, if I have to."
Interlude. These bodies. Dry weather bodies, endurance-gened bodies. One a body which had displayed stubborn determination as a kit, even before it was brought into personhood. One a body which had displayed a cunning intelligence, a sneaky body. The sort of kit the we near it laughed at, finding it underfoot, babbling in kit language, yowling its demands at all hours. These bodies, singing in the we, singing heat and sand and confusion interest in the closed off but persistent minds of the enemy, just as their precedents had. Singing also now in surprise, stutter burst fascination, horror,
disjointed cords. One of the bodies of their silent enemy had brought strands of person-maker, had not consumed the person-maker, but locked it in a plastic box, like it was poison, like the we were poison. The bodies in the sand and the heat tried to make sense of this, to not think language or equivalence of narrative, why would we, but to attempt to link concepts that had never been possible previously, to think, not a person, and also, knows how to be a person, and also, does not want personhood, does not want to sing, fractal, reflected, iterating across the void home. To cross-reference, those bodies that only sang an iteration of piloting and were silent otherwise. To echo fear across the we, fear in the shape of the silent enemy. To imagine only wanting a partial singing. The silent enemy body speaks in the language of mouths, senselessly. When the cunning, sneak somebody plucks the person-maker from its clawless hands, it yowls briefly and then silences itself. It is very still and very watchful, and the stubborn, determined body sings person, and the cunning, sneak somebody sings not a person, not singing. And these threads of melody reverberate endlessly through the we. And at the same time, aflame with icy determination, the fleet captain's 16 Moonrise, sometimes called Ascent, by the man who was her most beloved teacher, whom she wishes she could trust entire. But why then did he send her out this far, to this war, where she is like to die? Sends out orders to her legion. The 24th responds to her as if they were extensions of her hands, of her breath. They gather themselves, they assume strike formation, they begin, cautiously still, to advance. And 16 Moonrise keeps a steady hand on their leash. She will wait a little longer yet, a little longer yet, for wondering why 11 Laurel sent her here, and for the Yautlek to come to the inevitable conclusion that to avoid an endless war, they must begin with an unanswerable atrocity. Paloa 2, 1,000 times over. The we slip in and out of black void home, the way the we slip in and out of jump gate space. All places are, in some sense, the same, where there is the iterative song resounding, dirt home or blood home, or starflyer home in the dark between the stars. To think, there is a change. To think, knowing the confusion of the bodies in the sand and the heat, the silent ones have turned away from the person-maker and moved together now toward the nearest blood home of ours. To think, to sing, to shriek, ah, 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 there are 1,000,000 bodies there, 1,000,000,000, too many to lose at once, so much silence to rebuild. And, as all things do on the original dirt home of the we, when they decide to move, their three-ringed ships a glimmer of distortion against the stars, they move all together, one murmuration, in many directions. And this time, they move to flank their enemy and drive them away before they can even think to arrive at their ultimate precious destination. One swarm of diving, singing ships, suddenly alive in the heart of the 17th Legion, who scrambles too late all of their shards to push the we away. And another murmuration heads for the jump gate from where the silent enemy came, in all their vast spear-point ships, came through this one point, only into the parts of the void home that belonged to the we, came some time ago, with their little resource extraction colonies, and came much more recently with firepower and threat, and the eternal inquisitive reach that should belong only to sentient persons. That murmuration comes hidden and flowing to the jump gate, and begins to pass through, one and the other, and the other, and the other.
Dekakel Onchu wakes to alarms, to a nightmare she's dreamed often enough that she has to convince herself that it is real. The aliens are coming through the Unhamamet Gate. She moves on instinct and training, on the voice of her Imago line giving her enough space to breathe, to not hyperventilate or panic. She is the counselor for the pilots. Her ancestors brought Lascelles Station safely to rest. If she has to, she will bring every last one of the station's citizens to a new home, even Aknel fucking Amnarbat, who she has still not decided what to do about, except figure out how to make a counselor not a counselor anymore, and how to get Daj Taratz to help her do it. But she doesn't want to have to find a new station. Dream up all those fragile numbers, like the first pilot in her Imago line did. Start the world over again. So she scrambles all of the military craft Lascelles Station and every other substation in Bardzrovan sector have, and prepares to meet the threat face to face. She is in the hangar bay, watching her pilots climb into their ships, when she spots a tall, cadaverous shape, who can only be Daj Taratz. Him, she stops. Him, she asks to justify himself. Now, after all this, after what he has done and condemned the station to suffer. Now? He is taking a flitter ship and running away. Alone. How many counselors are going to betray their duty to Lascelles Station today? First, Amnarbat. And how she is going to deal with Amnarbat is clearly something that will have to be considered after this conflagration, if there is an after to consider problems in. And now Taratz, abandoning the station. And Daj Taratz says to her,
"No, I'm not running away. I'm going to get Mahit Dasmar, and we are going to redirect this war."
Onchu doesn't know. We'll never quite know why she lets him leave. Perhaps she thinks he'll die trying to get through the far gate, and none of it will matter. Perhaps she thinks he might manage what he says he's trying to do. And if he can, she will have less blood to mop up. The cartograph table in 11 Laurel's office is small. It fits on a side table half as long as his desk. He runs it all the time, a sort of background music, 1,000 solved military puzzles replaying beside him as he does the work he is required to do. He likes to think it lets him remember his history. His history, his ministry's history, his empire's history. He's an old soldier, 11 Laurel is, and decades gone from a battlefront he personally had to solve. Old soldiers need to keep their teeth, and 11 Laurel sharpens his on the knotty flesh of centuries worth of Tixkalanli campaigns, played out again in pinpoints of light. He has it on now. It is playing some battle in a double star system from 2 centuries ago, and he isn't watching it at all, except for how the lights shift across his hands. His ministry's history. His ministry's successes. How fragile they can turn out to be. In the hands of a Yautlek, who would rather be an emperor. And the reactions of an emperor who came to her throne in the aftermath of that Yautlek. 11 Laurel is an old soldier. He thinks of the shards, tied together with new technology from the science ministry, shifted and strange, not quite trustable. More like the sunlit than his fellow soldiers now, in their worst moments, which are also their undeniable tactical best ones. He thinks of slow poison, and of trust, of what he has asked his favorite student to die for, all unknowing, in hopes of preserving his ministry's history, his ministry's successes, cutting away what might be susceptible to rot, or the suspicion of rot. 16 Moonrise is an acceptable sacrifice. If she takes 9 hibiscus with her and wins a victory for war, that will keep war relevant in the new emperor's estimation for as long as the conflict continues. In the 17th Legion, all the shards together, linked by shard sight and biofeedback and the other thing, the shard trick, they call it, when they're alone amongst themselves,
No superior officers, no non-pilots. The shard trick, where sometimes it isn't just proprioception and pain that are shared between each shard, but instinct, reaction time, and in moments of extremity or beauty, thought. Not words exactly, but communication. The ones who like it, and only a small percentage of shard pilots like the shard trick, have pushed its limits, recited poetry to one another without ever opening their mouths. Recited poetry to one another from either side of a jump gate, and heard. A distorted echo, a vibration in the bones. Something from a sector of space utterly disconnected from this one, save for the stitch of the jump gate, and the vast breathing shard sense. All the shards together, in the 17th Legion, whether they like the shard trick or not. Dying under the slick, dissolving ship spit of the three-ringed alien enemy, under the flashes of energy cannon fire. Dying. And it hurts. And there are a very great many of them dying. A long way away, in the sector of Tixkalanli space which holds the jewel of the world, and also the 3rd Legion cruiser, Verdigris Mesa, 4 shard pilots on a training exercise return to the hangar base screaming, weeping. They help each other from their ships, stand braced and linked as if they cannot bear to be alone. And one of them says, thread of sense within their sobbing, truly it does not matter which one, "We need to speak with the Minister of War. Code Hyacinth, now!"